Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Ah. The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Welcome to episode 520. It's a best of, a replay of an episode from 2012 with my friend Jesse Perez. I'm Paul Gilmartin. This is the Mental Illness Happy Hour, a place for honesty about all the bullshit rattling around in our heads. This is not meant to be a substitute for professional mental counseling. I'm not a therapist, not a doctor's office, more like a waiting room that doesn't suck. Our sponsor for today, as always, is BetterHelp.com. Online counseling, that's BetterHelp.com. If you're interested in trying online counseling, go to BetterHelp.com/mental. Make sure you include the slash mental part so they know you came from this podcast. And then fill out a questionnaire, and if they feel they have a counselor who's a good fit for you, they will pair you up with one, and you can experience a free week of counseling. And you need to be over 18, and BetterHelp is licensed in all 50 states. Highly, highly recommend it. All right, without any further ado, here is the best of with Jesse Perez. I'm here with my friend Jesse Perez, who I've known for probably about 7 years. I think we met in about 2004. And you're somebody that I just immediately was drawn to. Your sense of humor, you're one of the least phony people I know. And I've always been drawn to people like that. So when you agreed to do this podcast, I was very excited. And I got to say, I'm a little... I don't know if intimidated is the right word, but I care very much what you think of me, and I don't want to let you down, and I just wanted to get that out of the way up top.
Okay, well, just so we're clear on it, I have a very low opinion about you all the way around, pretty much, so we're good. Let's be clear on that. You don't have to worry anymore.
Why you got to make it a race war right out of the gate?
No, I think the reason we have a connection is because we think highly of each other, and I kind of, you know, the same thing you say about me, I can say about you.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. Jesse's story, and obviously I'll let him tell it, but I've just always been interested in it, and I can never hear enough of it. And you're not somebody that walks around talking about themselves. Which to me makes it even more interesting. Let's start from the beginning. Can you talk about where you were raised, what your home environment was like?
I was born in East LA, mm-hmm. and I was raised in the San Gabriel Valley. I had seven brothers and sisters. I was in the middle. I had four brothers and sisters from one father and four brothers and sisters from another father. So we had a definite defining line in who we are, who we were under the same roof.
Oh, really? Now, that I never knew. And was your father the one who was living with you? Or was he the one who left?
He was the one who was asked to leave.
Okay.
My mother was, she was married twice, and so there was four of us from one father and four from the other. Yeah. My stepfather raised me. My mom was married to my stepdad, and then he went to prison. And while he was in prison, my mom met my dad, and she was with him for about 7 or 8 years or whatever it was that defined common law. And in that time, she had four kids from him. And then when my stepdad got out of prison, my dad was out of the picture. Right before he got out of prison, my dad was asked to leave because of, for whatever reason, their marriage failed. And then my stepdad coming out of prison was the one that raised me pretty much.
Well, let's talk about your history with trouble and the law. And I know you don't want to glamorize or romanticize your past, and that's certainly not my intention to do that, but I can tell you as a white kid from the suburbs, there are aspects of your past that are fascinating to me, and I don't want to sensationalize them, but I think they're interesting. So at the risk of sensationalizing them, can you tell me what it's like to be a gangbanger and shoot heroin?
Well, I'll tell you what. I'm glad you made that point, because I know so many guys that really, really do glamorize it.
Yeah.
And I mean, our whole society, that whole like hip hop mentality.
Yeah.
I mean, I got a son who makes rap music. He's a hip hop guy, and we're both into music in a big way. And I love that I don't like that style of music, but I like that the creativity of it. And my son likes to write like I like to write, which is very cool. But that whole gangster mentality, you know, now there's guys, white boys from the suburbs,
sure,
that are gangsters because of that. They listen to the music and they get caught up in it, and then you throw alcohol and drugs in the mix and everybody's Al Capone now, you know, or whatever.
Yeah.
And so for me, you know, I don't glamorize it or think that I see it as a lot of fun, because I've seen the other side of it.
Mm-hmm.
I've been around guys that are real gangsters. And I, you know, I never was, but I knew guys that were. And so I see, you know, I see the other side of it. And it's not always a party.
Yeah.
It's not a poolside party getting loaded, you know?
Now, when you say you weren't a gangster, are you being sarcastic?
Not at all. I mean, you know, well, here's the deal. I think, and that's the point that I'm making, is that a lot of people believe if they dress a certain way and they listen to certain music and they talk a certain talk, and, you know, that they are that person that the Godfather was about.
Right.
And they get caught up in that, and I call it a gangster mentality. And really what it is all Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
It's all Hollywood.
So you never belonged to a gang?
Of course I did. I was a gang member. I was a gang member from about 11 years old till probably 26.
So what's the difference between being a gang member and being a gangster?
Well, for me, the gangsters were the guys that were running business. And that was the business end of that lifestyle, you know, the movement of the drugs and the criminal element.
Right.
And I got involved in it. I did. But there was always the guys that existed at a higher level than me. And of course, that was the plan for me. I was planning on moving up and getting my way, you know, working my way to the top, what they call the top. But
Which is Pelican Bay.
Well, that's the top. I mean, it is.
Pelican Bay is a prison in Northern California where some of the most hardcore gang members and criminals are housed. Did you ever do time at Pelican Bay?
Not at all. I've done time, but I don't, you know, I've done a little bit of time. Through the years, I think by the time I was done going to jail, it had been a total of about 8.5 years. And it was at different places that...
Well, didn't you turn 18 in Folsom?
No.
No?
No. No? No, not at all. Not me.
Oh, you're being sarcastic.
No, It wasn't me. No. And here's the deal. There's a lot of guys, I try and, it's funny you ask me that question, because there's guys that come up to me in the circles that I hang in, and they ask me questions like, you know, you've been here. I says, no, I haven't. And they says, yes, you have. And I'm telling them, like, no, I haven't. And they have this idea that they know where I've been more than I know where I've been.
Well, for some reason, I could have sworn I heard you say that you turned 18 in prison. Did you turn 18 in prison?
No, I was busted, but I wasn't in prison when I turned 18, but I was in jail.
Oh, okay.
So there's a difference. I mean, and that's why a lot of guys, they tell me that they know where I've been, and they don't. And they don't. They get pieces of my story, and they come up to this conclusion of who they think I am, and they're more concerned about my time than I am. They really are.
Yeah.
And that's the whole idea. That's why I don't get in conversation about it, because a lot of guys, they're more excited about my past than I am.
Right.
Like, they're really interested in it. And I, you know, one guy got me so angry about asking me about it, about the details. I told him, why don't you go get a gun and do some robberies and create your own story? I mean, come on, give me a break,
you know,
because they get so much excitement over where they think I've been.
Right.
And most guys don't know because they don't listen to what I say.
Right.
You know, they're like, there's so much excitement, like people want to know about it. And you know what? I don't think people want to know about it.
I think people want to know about it if that person has been able to distance themselves from it.
Right.
And because you've been able to distance yourself from it, that's why I think it's a worthy story. Somebody acting like an asshole and shooting people and, you know, all the things that people are in jail for nowadays, the selfish, egotistical things that they do, that to me doesn't make a story. But somebody seeing the error of their ways and learning to live a different way, that to me is a compelling, interesting story. And so that is one of the reasons why I wanted to talk to you, because you've overcome things other than that I want to get to as well. But let's talk about when you're 11, how does the trouble begin?
I got introduced to getting loaded at like 10. Mm-hmm. At least getting drunk at 10. And then I got introduced to other things between 10 and 11, which is like 69, 70. And I got introduced to other things, you know, the weed. And I think we were even sniffing paint, and people were sniffing glue. I never sniffed glue, but sniffing paint, weed, reds, whites. And this is at a young age, and I'm an experiment. Had it, tried it a couple of times, and it wasn't a big deal.
Reds and whites, is that like second-alls and two-and-alls?
Right.
Okay.
Or downers and uppers.
Yeah.
You know, from, yeah. So, okay. And what was going on at home was Mom was struggling to keep us fed. There was eight of us, and so I had a lot of free time, and I had a lot of time on my own. And at my house, my brother was a leader in the neighborhood. And so a lot of the guys that were older than me used to come to the house, and I would pick up on what was going on with them. I had an uncle living with us who just recently passed away, and he was kind of schooling me.
When you say that your brother was a leader in the neighborhood, you mean that in a gang?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Right. He was the guy that I followed. I mean,
sure. How much older was he than you?
Maybe 3 years.
Okay.
Yeah, he's about 54 right now, 54, 55. And you know, he set the bar for me. He was a respected guy, and
did girls like him?
And the yeah, I think so.
Okay.
I think so.
But what was it? Was it his power and the fact that people listened to him and gave him respect that kind of?
It wasn't his so much what he said. It was the things he did, and I knew that's where we got our respect. That's where we got our recognition in the neighborhood, was the things we were willing to do.
Like what was the things that he did or was willing to do?
He was kind of one of the guys. He was a fighter,
mm-hmm.
and he went up, and he was the kind of guy that would want to go up against numerous guys, and he was a fighter, and that's what he was, and he was a good fighter. And that was kind of the shadow that I walked in. I kind of hung on to his reputation as a kid, but, you know, that turned around to bite me in the ass, because eventually, you know, I could ride on his coattails for a little while, and then eventually I had to do my own work. And the thing in the neighborhood was about everybody trying to out-crazy each other.
Yeah.
You know, a compliment was how crazy you were and the things you were willing to do.
Yeah.
And for me, I tried to learn, you know, because I started getting arrested at a young age, and I'd go to juvenile hall or the camps or whatever.
Now, how old were you when you were arrested for the first time?
The very first time I was, I think, 9.
No.
Yeah. I was either 9 or 10. And what it was is I used to, because, you know, I used to watch the stuff around me, and I wasn't really doing anything, even though I drank once or twice. I used to carry this buck knife for show. Mm-hmm. And one day we were down at the school down the street from our house, and some kid came and tried to take my bike from me, or threatened to take it. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, and I, of course, I told him, no way, you know, and I pulled out my buck knife mm-hmm. that I used to stone. I had it like razor sharp.
Yeah.
And I carried it for looks, of course. And, you know, and when I pulled it out, he went and grabbed it, reached to grab it. And when he grabbed it, I just pulled it real quick. And, you know, I cut his fingers down to the bone or whatever. I cut his fingers up pretty bad.
Yeah.
And that scared me. And I jumped on my bike, and me and my partner, and we raced to my house. He went home, and I went inside, and I was so scared. And then I heard the knock on the door. And I already knew who it was, and I look out the curtain, it's the cops, and it's the kid I cut and two other kids, the witnesses.
Yeah.
And so I opened the door like I'm going to play dumb, right? I'm like, I'm like 10 years old, and I'm thinking I'm going to go toe-to-toe with this cop and challenge, you know, our intellect here or whatever, you know? And so I open the door. He starts reading me my rights.
Really?
And the other kids are like, that's him, that's him. And my mom, you know, in the middle of him reading me my rights, my mom being on the other side of the door somewhere, caught wind of, you know, heard it, and walked up and like, what the hell's going on here? And he's like, you know, and he's, you know, he told her what happened, and I looked at my mom and I said, the kid tried to take my bike, you know, and they took me to jail with my, I think my mom went with me, and they cited me, and I was in there for an hour or something, and then they released me, and I thought they were wrong, you know. And the second time was right after I was in a market down the street from my mom's, and I was in the market, and I seen a little cap gun in the food section, but unwrapped, just laying on the food. And so I grabbed it and I stuck it in my pocket, and I really didn't think that I was stealing. Mm-hmm. I didn't think I was stealing. I thought, well, and I didn't think a kid came and left it there, but I didn't think I was stealing for whatever reason.
Right.
Stuck it in my pocket, started walking out the door, and I got busted. And they, you know, they called the cops, they arrested me, and they arrested me for shoplifting. And I thought they were wrong. Mm-hmm. You know, I really thought they were wrong. As a kid, I thought. And at that, those two incidents, I started developing this mindset of society versus me.
Wow.
The man versus me.
Yeah.
And then, of course, back then, there was a little bit of, you know, that racial tension was going on back then. It was, you know, for us, they called them Tijuaneros, TJs, mm-hmm. because most of the Mexicans back then came from Tijuana. Mm-hmm. They weren't from San Salvador and, you know, South yep. America and all right. that. They were from right on the other side of the border.
Right.
So we called them TJs. Mm-hmm. And so for me, even as a young kid at about 10, 11 years old, my given name was Jesus. And I was called Jesus because I was born on Christmas Day. And I changed it to Jesse because I didn't want to be confused for those people from the other side of the border.
Really? I never knew that.
Yeah. And so, and back then, you know, there was always this tension between what I come from is what are called Chicanos, which are, you know, American, Mexican heritage, mm-hmm. you know, Americans. And these guys are Mexicans from Mexico, mm-hmm. which is where my, you know, my dad's mom and dad are from. But, you know, we didn't want to, there was a difference between us. And believe it or not,
did you look down on them?
I think the reason, I didn't really look down on them, but I think that it seemed like society looked down on us like we were the same people as they were, and we weren't.
Would it be fair to say that you felt like they were making your life harder? They were dragging you down a bit?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely, because we were thrown in this class of, you know, a Mexican's a Mexican, which means whether we're from California or Mexico, we're the same people, mm-hmm. and we're not. And And so, I mean, as a kid, you know, you try and you're trying to find yourself, find out who you are. Mm-hmm. And we come from poverty, and we come from what do you call it? Broken marriages or broken homes or whatever. And you try and find your place and try and determine the person that you are, even apart from your family, but as an individual, who you are. And so for me, I think the most natural thing for me to do was to gravitate toward that lifestyle that I gravitated toward, because there was recognition, there was status, there was a good time, there was rebellion against that system that we felt. There wasn't prejudice under my mom's roof, but there was a sense of, for wherever it came from, it wasn't from my mom, but there was something in there that said, we were the way we were because the white man did it to us. Mm-hmm. There was something there. It was subtle, but it was there.
Yeah.
You know, so when you see things like, I remember, even though I was a kid, I remember when Bobby Kennedy got shot. Mm-hmm. I remember when Martin Luther King got shot. And I remember being so driven toward that movement, whatever it was, whatever I could decipher that it was as a kid with that mentality. Mm-hmm. And I became a fan of, I called it the Kennedy movement. I started studying John F. Kennedy in elementary school. I would think I was probably 3 years old when he got killed. Mm-hmm. So I didn't really know him or of him. And when Bobby Kennedy got killed and Martin Luther King, it kind of, you know, and then the East LA riot, they had the East LA riot, which was the, they were protesting against the front lines in Vietnam, and then it blew up when Ruben Salazar was killed.
He got hit with a flare gun in his head, with the
tear gas, and they called it an accident, and it was far from an accident.
It was aimed directly at his head from, like, what, 3 feet away or something?
No, the cop was at the door, and Ruben was behind the curtain, one of them plastic curtains that you could see through in a
right.
bar.
Right.
And they shot him point blank in the head with it. But the thing about that is there's such a conspiracy. You know, they recently had a reopening of that case. And what they did is they let the daughter see the evidence, but they didn't reveal any of the evidence to the public. They let her see the evidence alone without an attorney for a limited time, and then they closed it and said that it was officially, it was what they said it was. Mm-hmm. But when they called the cops, it was called the Silver Dollar Cafe, when they called the cops, because there was protests going on about the front lines of Vietnam, and what they were saying is that the front lines were filled with Chicanos, mm-hmm. and they were being murdered and then replenished with more Chicanos in the front line in Vietnam, and that's what the march was about.
And the white man was saying, no, we throw some blacks in there.
Yeah, or whatever, yeah, or whatever, you know, whatever they were saying, but the thing was is that when Salazar, when they found out he was in the bar, there was a call. And I don't know how, they say there was a call that said that there was a man with a gun in this bar.
I see.
And so I've talked to witnesses who were there, and they said there must have been about 15 cop cars that showed up there, like really, really, really quick.
Mm-hmm. So it seemed like a setup.
Well, yeah, because, I mean, you got 100,000 people marching, mm-hmm. and all of a sudden you got this attention on this one place, mm-hmm. and you go in there, and by chance, this guy who brings cases against authority and against the cops and challenges...
And who was writing in papers, and writing things
right.
very unfavorable to the establishment.
Right.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
so, and they shot him point blank and hit with a tear gas. They say they shot it on the ceiling and it came down and ricocheted and hit him in the head, but further investigation shows that they shot him point blank.
Yeah.
So, yeah, he, you know...
So things like that contributed to that idea that it's us versus them.
Yeah, but you got to understand too that everything. The only reason I share these stories is these are the excuses that I had.
Right.
Okay, these are part of that foundation that I built for myself because I was drawn to that way of thinking by choice, mm-hmm. because I had 7 siblings and not all of us lived the same way.
Right.
You know, I mean, 2 of my sisters and. Or maybe one of my sisters and one of my brothers and a little bit of the other brother. I mean, you know, we didn't all join a gang.
Right.
You know, and we didn't all turn into drunks and dope fiends.
Right.
We didn't, you know, but this is what I did.
That moved you. This lifestyle and that emotional kind of component resonated with you, and you thought, this feels natural to me. I'm going to move towards this. But you weren't, obviously, if you were a fan of Bobby Kennedy, all white people weren't bad, just kind of the ones that were currently in power.
Yeah. And it wasn't even, like I said, under my mom's roof, it wasn't talked about, like, you know, my mom definitely wasn't a racist, or my stepdad, or, but there was just something, there was like that hum or that tone. Mm-hmm. Maybe it was the news, maybe it was the paper, you know, the media, the way they would blow things up. And as a kid, you're kind of putting these pieces together and creating your own reality. Mm-hmm. Because I'm not going to my mom and asking her to clear things up for me.
Right.
I'm not going to ask her to, you know, like today, you know, I go to my kids and we have open dialogue. I mean, but I never went to my mom and said, explain this to me.
Right. Plus, I think sometimes there doesn't have to be the presence of something to say that these people are making life difficult for you. Sometimes it's the lack of you seeing your face on television in a way that is healthy. You seeing your face on a billboard for a product. You know, you not seeing yourself become a part of the fabric of society. I would think that in and of itself would be enough to say, hey, we're not sitting at the table.
Yeah, for sure. And think of that. That's 69, 1969, 1970, 1971. Today, when I watch the news, you know, it's, you know, and me and my mom kind of share this kind of same, I see the news and not to sound racist, but this is going to sound racist, but I see the news and then I see these guys that are pedophiles or rapists or these guys, you know, and when I hear the surname and I think, you know, and I hear it and I get ashamed. And I told a friend of mine who's white, and I told a friend of mine one time, I said, what do you think about, you know, it's like, it really bothers me that most of the time I hear these guys and they're Mexicans. Well, he says, it's just a numbers thing. He says, look at how many Mexicans are in California.
Right.
Look at how many Mexicans are in Los Angeles.
Right.
I mean, that's kind of the way it's gonna come out, is it's going to sound like there's more of them getting arrested because there's more of them in the area.
Right.
That's just kind of the way it's going to, you know, I mean, if we're in Kentucky or wherever, and you're not going to hear,
right,
you know, Gonzalez and Garcia, and, you know, you're not going to hear it like you hear it out here. And then that kind of gave me a little bit of, I think.
Yeah, because I don't think, you know, I've lived here in Los Angeles for 16 years, 17 years, and when that thought has never occurred to me that they're, you know, most of the pedophiles or rapists are Hispanic.
See, and that's where my ear tunes to when I hear it. You know, it's like today, this morning, I heard, the news. I listen to the news every day, or I read it on the internet, and this woman, you know, she tried to drown her kids,
mm-hmm.
two kids. One of them died, one of them's dying, or one of them's really bad.
Mm-hmm.
And I think she was black, I think. And, I didn't think, but I think to myself, you know, what is it that would drive a person to do that? And right now, it's really, really, really something I'm really sensitive to, only because we're coming to a mark with me and my girlfriend and the murder of her grandbaby.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Friday's going to be 6 months. And 6 months is when the DA is going to determine whether or not they're going to pick up the case and bring some charges against somebody.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so for me, there's a lot of, a lot of times I feel a little bit more about stories that I hear.
Right.
Because of something else I got going on with my own personal life or something in my past.
Yeah.
You know.
Tell the listener briefly, if you can, what the situation is with that, unless you'd rather not talk about that.
Let's see.
Maybe it's too complicated to talk about, but, you know, when you say, you know, the murder of my grandbaby, it's not something that I want to gloss over. I feel like as an interviewer, I would be, I don't feel that it's central necessary to the part of your story that I want to hear, but as an interviewer, I'm kind of torn because I don't want to be like, yeah, dead baby. Anyway.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Well, here's the deal. Malachi was 17 months old, and he was my girlfriend's son's son. And for about 2 months before he died, we hadn't seen the baby. But I had about as much time as my girlfriend did with the baby, so I became like a grandfather to the baby and, mm-hmm. you know, and treated him that way. And while he was under his mother's care, he was, it was, what do you call it, blunt force trauma to the head.
Mm-hmm.
They call it shaking baby syndrome. And then somebody hit him in the back of the head, and we didn't see it because he was, when we went to the hospital, he was already brain dead. And we were there with him for 3 days, and they kept him alive for 3 days because he was a donator, his body organs. Mm. And to this day, they haven't put handcuffs on anybody. They have six suspects. And they, the, so far the coroner determined that it was somebody took liberty with the baby for about 12 hours, which means either they were throwing him on the floor on carpet or on a headboard. They were doing injury to him with some thought behind it because they were making sure that the injuries weren't showing, and that's what they did.
Mm.
And so, you know, Friday's going to be, we're kind of working on plan B right now to see what we're going to do if the DA doesn't put any handcuffs on anybody or decides they're not going to pick it up. And
wow.
So, yeah.
I got to say, this is the 48th episode I've done of this show, and I don't think anything has made me more sad than hearing that somebody deliberately throwing a baby around.
It's one of those things that, you know, I don't talk about.
Yeah.
It's because it's too big for me. It's too painful. It just is. It's just, and I get to levels of rage and anger and you know, because of the person that I am today, you know, there's a lot of rediscovering of who I am through this whole episode because, mm-hmm. you know, you wanna try and, for me, because of who I am today and the life that I live, I try and live my life according to what I think God's will is in my life.
Mm-hmm.
I go to prayer every day. I do meditation. I do these things to stay connected to my God, to keep me grounded, because my reaction to this thing is like yours and anybody else's, except that it's home for me, you know, and it's family to me.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really hard.
You
it's
know,
really hard.
When I think of what, and maybe this sounds like a bunch of horseshit and me just rationalizing, but the person that does something like that to the baby, the easiest thing in the world is to say that person's not a human being, you know, they're et cetera, et cetera. I look at whoever would do something like that and I think, A, that person has to know what they're doing is wrong. So obviously something inside them, a darkness and anger, is so compelling and so overwhelming to them that they can't stop themselves. And I feel, sympathy is not the right word, but I, you know, like when I see stuff about a serial killer, I think those people, they, a part of them knows what they're doing is wrong and wants to stop and they can't. And I feel a certain empathy with somebody because I know what it's like to feel overwhelmed by feelings and want to pick up a drink or drugs or cut somebody down or do something. And I think these people, they've got that times a thousand, and then they're walking around thinking to themselves, you're a fucking baby killer, or you're a pedophile, or you're a serial killer. And I think that what a fucking prison that must be. Now that I'm not letting them off the hook by any means, but don't you think any God would want you to look at that person with some portion of that type of empathy? Or am I just being a liberal bleeding heart?
You are being a liberal bleeding heart, but
and I think that person should certainly go to jail or maybe be subject to the death penalty, but
there was a guy, I was at a retreat 1 year, and this, I think he was a Jesuit priest, said, and he shared a story about a retreat he put on, and he's telling us what he told that group, and what he told them was that God forgave Hitler for what he did to the Jews.
Mm-hmm.
That was simply how he, I'm gonna paraphrase, I'm gonna make it as small as possible. And so what happened is some of the people in that congregation or in that group came to him afterwards, and they happened to be ancestors of people that were murdered in Auschwitz.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they were grandchildren of people or something right. to that effect. And what he was, the point he was trying to make was the difference between our ability to love and forgive and God's ability to right. forgive and right. to love. And that was the thing, that one thing that made us different from God.
Right.
And I think there's one thing that I remember.
Were those people upset that he had said that?
Yeah, but he explained it to them, and right. this was what he was talking about, you know, and they understood. They got it. And so what I try and remember is that my friend of mine, he was a spiritual advisor of mine, he used to tell me to think like, what would Christ do?
Mm-hmm.
In that situation, in any situation that comes in my life where I'm very judgmental of somebody.
Mm-hmm.
And so instead of thinking to myself, I'm only a human being, I'm a man, so it's kind of hard for me to think that I can be like Christ. But I got what he was saying, the gist of what he was saying was just kind of have that way of thinking.
Mm-hmm.
But I would think, what would he do, my spiritual advisor, Ray? Not Christ, but what would he do as a human being, as a man? And that was more... tangible for
doable.
Me. More doable. Am I in a position right now that I can forgive somebody for doing that? No. Am I capable one day of doing that? Maybe. Mm-hmm. Maybe. Right now? No. Not at all. Am I expected to? I don't think so.
Well, let's lighten things up and talk about prison and gang shootings. and heroin addiction.
Yeah, I'll tell you, My jail time was really, really little. It was very, very it was very uneventful. It was very boring.
You said a total of 8 years. That's not little.
It is in the bigger scheme of things. It is.
You like to call it, I went on a vacation. That's how Jesse always refers to it. This one time I was on vacation.
Well, you know, the thing was is that you know, I call them timeouts now, but the timeouts were very necessary, because if I didn't have the timeouts I had, I might have ended up dead.
Yeah.
Really, because what I would do is I would go to jail and you know, whether it was for a few months or a couple of years or whatever it was.
What was it usually behind, like robberies or?
I did some time for robbery, but most of them were robberies actually, and the other stuff.
Was it to feed your drug habit or to earn money for the gang?
I never went to earn money for nobody but me.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I did business. With guys, and we had business to do for the neighborhood. But, you know, you come to find out real quick, they call it one thing and it's something else. I mean, really, you come to find out that the loyalty is not loyalty at all.
Yeah, you're dealing with criminals.
Everybody, yeah.
I really, mean, he's taken more than his cut.
No, but see, the thing is you kind of get this idea in the beginning when I first got into it, and because there are guys, and I know them today, that are still alive that I trusted with my life, and I trusted everything that they told me, and for the most part I was right. But then there was these other guys that sat in our circle that were working both sides of the fence, and we didn't know till. You know, somebody end up dead or somebody end up in prison or whatever it was. I mean, you just don't know who you're sitting in the circle with. And I got out of it at 25, 26 years old. You know, I stopped drinking at 24, but, you know, for a couple of years I was still kind of in the business a little bit. But I got out of it. And, you know, the guys that I was sitting in circles with, they were killing each other. Mm-hmm. You know, they sit there one day shaking each other's hands and looking at them in the eye and, you know, telling them they love each other and all that. However they said it, that expression of, you know, you're my brother and all that stuff. And next thing you know, that, you know, somebody's dead and the guy that was shaking his hand was involved in that decision and all that bullshit, you know. So, you know, that's where I come from. I mean, and so for me.
At what age did you realize there really isn't nobility in this? It's every man for himself. And these guys are, the rats often that they say that they despise.
I was probably a couple of years before I got out of it. You know, it's one thing to know it, but then to make the move.
Yeah, how hard is that?
You know, a lot of people believe that maybe the societal attitude is that, you know, you're in a gang and you're in a gang for life, and they get that whole dramatic spin on it. I'm kind of respected for the changes I've made for the people that knew me, the ones that were real friends, you know, because they knew who I was. And to see who I am today, you know, it's like I watched a TV show recently a few months back, and there was three of us as kids, me, my best friend, and another guy, and that other guy killed my best friend, okay? And that other guy, I seen him on TV recently up in...
The guy that killed your best friend?
Yeah, and he was doing some kind of scared straight thing, you know.
Uh-huh.
I saw him on TV, and you know, he'll never get out, and he doesn't know that I know that he killed my best friend.
Oh, he's in for something else.
Yeah. He never got tried. He never even got tried for that, you know, but he had enough stuff going on that... he'll never get out.
Right.
But I seen him on TV, and I remember when he killed my best friend, I was already into my change of life, and I was already into recovery, and I was already there for 5 years when he killed my best friend. And I was going to kill him,
yeah,
you know, for what he did. Even after being into my change of life for 5 years, I was going to go kill him. And I'm not a killer.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, really,
yeah.
I've known guys that have killed people, and I'm not. That's not me.
Have you ever shot at people?
Yeah, I've been shot, and I, you know.
How many times have you been shot?
Once.
And how many times have you fired bullets with the intent of hurting people?
A lot of times.
How many would you estimate?
Maybe. Maybe about 15.
And how many times have you seen a bullet that came from your gun hit somebody else?
Maybe four.
And are you comfortable saying what the outcome of that was?
Well, I know they all lived.
Okay.
But one guy I put in a wheelchair.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that?
You know, there's nothing to talk about. It's kind of, because I've gone through this already and I've dealt with it already, the other side of it is that, you know, there's things that I did when I was involved in that life that not only were expected of me, but... I embraced it. I loved it. I loved it. I loved the recognition. I loved the status I had. And I was one of the quiet ones.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I wasn't really, today, a lot of friends wouldn't believe it, but I was the quiet one. And I just watched everything that was going on around me. And when stuff happened, I got into the mix. I was into all the stuff.
Was it a rush? I would imagine it was.
Oh, it was a rush. Being scared that way, you know? Being shot at is a hell of a high.
Is it really?
You know, I was up here at this park out here in L.A., and this guy just started opening up in broad daylight, you know, and he caught me in the leg and dropped me. And it was just a flesh wound. It just chipped my bone, but it dropped me. But looking at him and seeing the fire in the gun, even though he was probably 70 yards out,
mm-hmm.
And seeing the flash of
the... Was it daytime or nighttime?
Daytime.
Yeah.
And I'm looking at him.
Yeah.
And I'm running, I'm looking at him, and he's shooting. And there's two of us or three of us, maybe three of us. And I got behind a tree. And he never hit the tree, but he hit my leg before I got behind the tree. And, you know, but that was one time. I mean, I've been shot at a few times. And you know... when you get out of it, I mean, it's scary. At you know, you get the rush and the adrenaline, all that stuff, and then the other side of it, you get the lump in the throat and the feeling of how close that was. And I've had a few of those experiences mm-hmm. where I should have died.
Yeah.
And you know, and you come out of it and like, wow, you know.
I think I know what that's like because I've drank espresso.
It's exactly like drinking a double espresso. I won't even touch that stuff. Yeah, it's kind of the same thing. Yeah, me and my brother were out one night, and we were in my mom's car, and this car drove on the side of us, and the guy is going down to reach for his gun, the passenger, and I'm the passenger, and my window is at the driver of mm-hmm. the other car. We're side by side, and his passenger is reaching for a gun, and I see him reaching. And my brother says, I don't know if the guy showed the gun or what he did. And my brother says, oh, don't worry about it. I don't know if, you know, I think the guy shot one shot. And my brother said, or I thought in my head that he was shooting blanks. Don't ask me why. I seen the fire coming out of the gun. He was raised over he stuck his body out the window and was over the top of the roof pointing mm-hmm. down at us and started shooting. and I seen the fire coming out of the gun. And for whatever reason, my head told me it was blanks. Don't ask me why. You know, because I'm real smart, right?
How old were you at this point?
Then I was probably about 20 or something like that. And we had just bought a box of beer bottles. We're drinking. And so I started grabbing the beer bottles and throwing at him as he's shooting. He's shooting. I'm throwing beer bottles at him. He shot. He got off about 6 rounds. We went down this main street. We went straight. They hung a right. And then we went home. And it was like, you know, we went and bought more beer and finished our night, went home. And the next day, I used that car, my mom's car, a little Toyota, a little box. And I went to the store, and I happened to stop at the park. I seen a guy I knew, and I stopped. We had a couple of beers. And as we're standing there drinking the beer, he says, "Who shot at you?" And I looked, and I hadn't said nothing yet. And I looked, and I said, "How did he know?" You know?
Yeah.
And I look, and there's a big old hole in the door, and it looked like a .45. It went through one door and halfway into the other one on the back of the car. Now, you know, when I seen it, because I wasn't drunk the night before, and I just kind of got this like rush of fear that came on me, and then I told this guy Jake, I told him what happened, and he's like, "Wow," he says, "it's pretty close." You know, and I'm thinking, I'm looking at myself the night before throwing beer bottles at this guy that's shooting at me. And what it is the kick on the gun and the 45s, you know, they're so hard that it's hard to... That was my saving grace.
Yeah.
Because he only hit the
22,
car.
You might have been dead.
Yeah, and he only hit the car one time, and he shot about 5 or 6 times. And that was one of those times when I says, you know, maybe... you know, it was one of those thoughts like, I might want to consider doing something else for a living. And it lasted about 10 minutes or 5 minutes, you know, and then it was gone. And, you know, you have a couple of beers. And it's like, wow, okay, you get over it.
when did your heroin use start?
I was a serious chipper is what I was.
You were a heroin prodigy, weren't you?
No. The first time I used heroin, I didn't get loaded on heroin until after I used it maybe 6 times. Mm. And the first time I used it, I went and bought a spoon, and I went to this guy's house in the neighborhood. And, you know, because I trusted dope fiends like you're supposed to, and I handed him the balloon, and he went and got his and went to the restroom and then came and gave me mine and, you know, all that good stuff.
So he stepped on your shit and gave you nothing.
He must have gave me nothing.
Yeah.
You know, and that was the first time. But the first time I got loaded, I was on a handball court. And
as most heroin addicts
do. And we're playing handball.
I was playing squash the first time I shot up.
Yeah. And this guy brought some, he broke out with some China White. Mm-hmm. And he says, you know, he put this little piece out like a match head, you know, little bit. And I'm like, you know, what's this going to do? And I had not yet gotten loaded on heroin. I've tried it like 5 or 6 times. And he says, "Trust me." He says, "You know, trust me on this. Just take that." He says, "If you want more when you're done with this, I'll give you more." So, you know, he tied me off and he gave it to me. And I remember the rig going into my arm. And when I woke up, I was about 3 miles away in somebody's shower, and they had me under the water. I went out.
Really?
I was out. And, you know, they said they thought they were going to lose me and all that good stuff. And my first response, and I'll never forget it, was, "I got to get some more of that." You know, "I got to get some more of that." And here's a deal that makes me different from other people.
Yeah.
This, you know, not that I deal with terminal uniqueness, but there was this, I remember a fair, I was just reminded of it. I went to a carnival or something when I was a kid, maybe 69, and they had this thing where they show the freaks, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they said, "This is what heroin does to babies." And I couldn't tell you if it had a third eye or if it had 2 heads. I don't remember. But what I do remember is my response in my head thinking, if drugs did that to that woman that gave birth to that baby, I want to try those drugs. If those drugs were that powerful, I want to try those drugs.
Right.
And that may have made me a little, you know, I thought about it through the years because I was 10 years.
That's not something normal people think.
Yeah. And I'm thinking, man, that's got to be some good shit, man. That's got to be some really, really good stuff.
Yeah. When you came out of your nod or whatever you want to call it, that first time you did the China White and you almost died, was there a feeling of euphoria when you awoke? Was the high still on?
Yeah.
Okay. It felt good even though had almost died.
Yeah, I was, yeah. It was like, you know, when you have great sex, mm-hmm. and afterwards you're having your cigarette moment and mm-hmm. you're just kind of laying there like, man, that was some great sex.
Yeah.
This is better than that.
Wow.
And you just kind of walk with that afterglow.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, then you start like, this is when I first got a little bit of a habit going. And as soon as that's coming down, my head's already going, you know, when we got to get some more of this.
We
got to get some more of this.
And so talk about that then, that lifestyle of feeding the dragon or whatever you want to call it, chasing the dragon.
That wasn't, I never thought I was a heroin addict. Mm-hmm. To the day I got clean, I never thought I was a heroin addict because I used to go on what we call runs. You know, I mean, you rearrange reality any way you want. And I did that all day long with myself. I turned into a speedballer. I was mixing cocaine and heroin. And I had friends of mine who were using $300 a day worth of heroin.
And this is back in the 80s.
Yeah. And they're using $300 a day. Those are the heroin addicts. You know, right. I never got past 125.
So you couldn't possibly be a heroin addict, right?
Yeah, these guys are bad. You know, yeah. So... And then I would go on these runs, and I could use for a month, 3 weeks, 2 weeks, and stop and be a little bit sick.
But getting sleep in between, not being up for three weeks.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay. And then I'd be a little bit sick, but I never got real, real dope sick. Hmm. You know, and the reason I never got dope sick is because I always had something else in my system. Hmm. You know, whether it was a minimum of booze, but I always had a buffer going on.
Yeah.
And don't ask me what it was, because a lot of times I stuck my hand in the candy jar and I didn't know what the candy was.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just the way it went, you know, whatever. But I needed, you know, I was one of them gutter, what do you call them?
Gutter hypes?
A gutter dope fiend.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I slammed cannabinol. I've slammed reds. I did heroin and cocaine. And I would eat whatever was on the table. That's why, you know, some people talk about their drug of choice.
Whatever
and
you
my
had.
Favorite, my favorite drug was whatever was on the table, man. Yeah. That was my favorite.
I totally relate to that. I think I've mentioned this on the podcast before, but one time I remember being in a parking lot after a show doing stand up, and I'm with strangers, complete strangers, and mind you, I'm on TV at this point. I've got a show. I'm making decent money. I could bought champagne if I wanted to. They're passing a thing that you use to clean off computer screens, and everybody's huffing off it, and they pass it to me. I think I even had a suit on, and I was like, sounds good. Took a drag off it.
Yeah, you're a lot sicker than I ever was, for sure. For sure.
But, you know, it's that whatever will take me out of me, a video game, pornography, drugs, alcohol, shopping, gossip, you fucking name it. It anything that will, in my mind, change my level in the universe.
I like what you shared about being around people you didn't even know. You know, I sat in some pretty tight circles of guys that really knew each other. But I also sat in circles of people that I had never seen before. And we were partying like if we had been friends for all our lives.
Sure.
And, you know, you end up in some, and then me, because of the work that I did, you know, I always carried a gun. So, you know, something would always happen, you know, and I'd be racing away from somebody's house or racing away with a cracked head or something, you know, something always, you know, you think a lot of times, you know, I would think, and this turned into self-judgment. You know, I would think, because I didn't know what an alcoholic was, and I didn't know, and I really didn't think, I thought I liked drugs, but I didn't think I was a drug addict. I wasn't, you know, real bad. So what you do is you think, well, if I'm not any of those things, and I never even wanted to consider them, because I wasn't no dummy. I thought if I ever called myself an alcoholic or an addict, somebody might ask me to stop. So I was never going to go there. I wasn't, didn't spend time thinking about it. But what I did do instead, I was more willing to say that I was stupid.
Right.
You know, because how else?
And unlucky.
And unlucky, yeah. I mean, why else would anybody do the things that I did?
Right.
I did some stupid shit.
Yeah.
And I did it even, I couldn't even blame the alcohol.
Yeah.
You know, when you're, when you're loaded as much as I was or drunk for so long and you do all this dumb stuff, because you're not loaded one day or drinking that day, you know, the stupid continues. You know, it just continues. The bad right. decisions, the bad right. choices, just the bad moves, just yeah. all the way around. It's just bad.
Yeah.
You know, so I, you know, so I thought to myself, man, you're just stupid. You know, nobody does stupid shit like that. The thing was, is I would go to family gatherings, and I love drinking with my family. I come from, you know, a lot of us, my cousins, and, you know, party. And it got to the point where, you know, I hadn't drank forever, how long it was, maybe a few days. And I'd sit in the circle in the living room or wherever, and I would crack a beer and it would get quiet. And you could hear the whispers, like, he's drinking again, or keep an eye on him. Mm-hmm. Or here we go.
Yeah.
Because I was either the violent drunk or the crying drunk. There wasn't a lot of gray area there.
Yeah.
You know, because that's why when people used to talk about, I drank to take the edge off, I drank to get fucked up. You know, I mean, I would call it that sometimes. I'd come home from work, get in my recliner, pull out my 12-pack or my 40-ounce or my beer or whatever, and I would sit there and say, you know, that whole thing in the head about, you know, I just worked a hard 8-10-12-hour day, come home, and that's what a man does. He has his beer. And but me, the funny thing happened when I drank a beer. Everyone I drank made me thirstier.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it seemed like everyone I drank, it just wasn't quenching that thirst, man.
Wasn't enough.
It just wasn't. I think about it now and I salivate.
Yeah.
You know, I remember because I was going to be a classy drinker, I think I started drinking Michelob instead of Colt 45. And I remember the taste of the Michelob, and I thought to myself, I've been drinking beer all these years and I never knew what a good beer tastes like. Yeah. I remember thinking that to myself, like, man, you've really arrived. You know,
that's
you finally
hilarious.
Arrived. Or when I had a full bar, when I finally got a full bar, right? My full bar was tequila, 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 one vodka, more tequila, 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 and some Jack Daniels and some Johnny Walker. And some, I had about 25 bottles of booze. And because at that time I was making some serious money in some of the business I was involved in. And I had this big old bar going. And the bar was a little bookshelf with the fifths on it in my living room.
Right.
That's what it was.
Right.
But I felt like I remember looking at that and thinking to myself, man, you've really arrived. This is what life's about.
There's no way you could be an alcoholic if you're drinking classy.
Oh, man.
What was the business at that point? Were you selling drugs?
I was helping to move drugs.
Yeah.
What kind of
volumes of drugs, and what drugs?
Heroin, cocaine, and weed. And as far as volume, that would change, because what I used to do is I used to be a runner. And I was like a delivery.
You didn't have to front any money. You just took the risk of getting caught with it.
Oh, yeah. I was delivery.
Probably paid well, huh?
Oh, well, you know, it never pays
enough.
Yeah. There wasn't a good dental plan going on, you know?
You factor in jail time, and it's really minimum wage.
And the 401k just wasn't worth the fuck, you know? Yeah. It just wasn't. Yeah, but, you know, you for whatever reason, you sell it to yourself that this is a good idea, because one is I'm staying loaded for free.
Mm-hmm.
Two is I'm staying fed. I'm keeping gas in the car, and I got a couple of bucks in my pocket, and I'm not having to punch a clock.
Mm-hmm.
And there it is there. That's wealth right there.
Sure.
You know, I mean, and I'm driving, I'm staying loaded. I'm in the party scene a little bit and dealing with these different people. And then every now and then guns get pulled and people get all stupid and it gets real different, real exciting, real quick. Mm-hmm. And game changers happen like that, and that's where people end up dead, or people end up in prison for the rest of life, or whatever.
Can you give me a little snapshot of an example of one of those things? When
one of the scariest moments for me, I was about 17 or 18, and maybe I was 19. Anyways, we're crossing the border, and there's like 10 cars, and we're all loaded with weed and other stuff, and the cars, you know, they're scattered. It's not like we're all in the same line. It's not like a funeral procession.
Right.
And we cross, and I get across, and I see two other cars make it across. And we're supposed to meet in San Diego, and we meet, and three cars are missing. And the three cars are missing are either six or nine guys. that are missing, and we never seen them again. To this day, to this day. And so what I had to do is, you know, one of those guys was a friend, and I had to go tell his mom. I didn't tell her what happened in detail. I just told her that he disappeared, you know. And that was, it should have been life-changing, a wake-up call to kind of say, you know what, I can't do this anymore. You know, this isn't for me, because I've gone through so many close calls, and this one was a close call for me, because I've been in jail in TJ before, and it's not fun.
Wow.
And this was a close call for me, because if I would have got caught in there, you know, whatever, they're, you know, I don't even think they're in prison. They're probably dead. I don't know. Yeah. But they never showed up again. They've never showed up since.
Tell the story about when the guy offered you the eyedropper in prison.
Oh, it was in the county.
Oh, county. Okay.
I went in to do 120 days, and I just stopped drinking.
So this is in like 85, 86?
Yeah, and I had to go in and do, I think, 120 days or 90 days or something. And I went in, and as soon as I went in, I was in there for a couple of days, and one guy that I knew that we had shared needles through the years on the streets a couple of times going through jail. And I went in, and he says, I got a loaded rig, you know, or he didn't say that. He just, whatever he said, he told me that he had a loaded eyedrop syringe with heroin in it. And he offered me a taste, and I just like, nah, you know, whatever. At the time, I was like 90 days sober.
Mm-hmm.
I had just stopped drinking and using. And I passed. And he didn't make a big deal out of it, you know, and he got loaded or whatever. When I was, and I got out that time, and I got drunk one more time. And then I was done. And 5 years into my own recovery, he died. I think he died in Folsom from AIDS. And according to the timeline, it could have, you know,
yeah.
That could have been one of the bullets I dodged for sure.
This episode is sponsored by When Breath Becomes Air. When Breath Becomes Air by Paul Kalanithi is the exquisitely observed memoir of an idealistic young neurosurgeon attempting to answer the question, what makes a life worth living, as he deals with his own terminal cancer diagnosis. It's a stunning reminder to live while we are alive, a must-read for anyone in medicine, from a doctor turned patient. For healthcare workers, expand your view on patient care and the fragile beauty of our mortal lives through Kalanithi's unforgettable words. Some of the questions Kalanithi wrestles with in this book include, what makes life worth living in the face of death? What do you do when the future flattens out into a perpetual present? When the future is no longer a ladder towards your goals in life? What does it mean to have a child, to nurture a new life as another fades away? When Breath Becomes Air is a number one New York Times bestseller, Pulitzer Prize finalist, and named one of the best books of the year by the New York Times Book Review, People, NPR, The Washington Post, Slate, and more. When Breath Becomes Air is available wherever books are sold. Learn more at prh.com/breath.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
In 2007, I'm going to fast forward now. In 2007, you and I had known each other for a couple of years, and you kept losing weight.
Huh.
And you kept getting more and more pale. And we kept saying, Jesse, are you sure you're okay? Are you sure you're okay? And you're like, I'm good. I'm not good.
Yeah, I found out I wasn't good.
Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I was. I had this flu going on that lasted like a really long time, probably like 13 weeks or something. And one of my buddies had he asked me, he says, something's wrong with you. Because you're right, there was a few guys that would ask me, what's up? And this one guy says, something's wrong. I says, you know what? I'm not sleeping at night. I don't know. I'm sleeping like 3 hours a night, and I'm having these cold sweats, you know? I says, it's like this really jacked up flu, this really hard flu. But I'm dealing with it. I'm good. He's like, nah, something's wrong.
And that's so you to do that too.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, what am I going to do? I mean, it's like, you know, I've been through some stuff in my life, and I just kind of like, you just write it out, you know?
Right.
And eventually the calendar kind of takes care of what's going on in your life, you know? Yeah. And this was one of those times when that didn't happen. And I lost, you know, I weigh 185 pounds right now. And I went down to about 121, 22 or something like that.
Yeah.
I had no strength in my legs. Anyways, I go to the doctor and right away they tell me I'm running on a half a tank of blood, and they want to give me a blood transfusion. I tell them I don't want to because I know people that have died from AIDS from a blood transfusion in my family, you know, actually my sister's mother-in-law and other people that I've known. And I just like, I says, nah, this isn't a good idea. And the woman says, you need some blood. You're running on a half a tank. And she says, we screen the blood pretty good. Don't worry about it. So they give me a blood transfusion.
And by the way, the screening for that nowadays is so much better than it used to be.
Yeah, oh, for sure, yeah. For sure. And so, you know, I went in and I did the blood transfusion, and I don't remember when I went. They let me out 7 days later. They gave me my vitamins, whatever I needed, and I felt better, and I came home, and I went back for another visit, and I did a blood test, and they told me I had cancer. And I was stage 3, and I had Hodgkin's lymphoma. And he said I had a good chance of recovering if I don't skip a beat on the treatment. And then right after they found the cancer, they found the Hep C, and I had both of them. And so I says, okay. And when he told me that, I thought, that explains a lot, for one thing.
And Hep C is hepatitis C.
Right. And I didn't... you know, stage 3 is kind of like, you know, when you have stage 4, you kind of start saying goodbye to people.
Right.
And stage 3 is kind of on that line, you know, and I was feeling it for sure. I mean, you've seen how I looked.
Dude, we literally thought we were going to lose you.
Yeah, and this was before I even knew I was sick. So when he told me that, I wasn't, it was really interesting, my reaction in my head, because I really didn't get scared. I didn't get scared. It was kind of one of those things that, and he kind of looked at me weird because he thought maybe, I was definitely in thought about what was going on, but he thought maybe I went into shock, mm-hmm. because because I was really into deep thought, like I'm kind of sorting what's going on here, you know, that I know I could die from this. I know I can. And so I'm just kind of coming to terms with it in my own head as he's, you know, kind of going kind of quick. And then he just kind of asked me, are you okay? And I'm like, yeah. And I says, you know, this isn't a surprise. I mean, I smoked for 31 years. I smoked them Camel non-filters for about 28. And I put all these chemicals in my body. I'm a painter, and I drank and I drugged and I did all this stuff. This is kind of an inevitable for me more than a surprise. I told
right.
him that.
Yeah.
And he says, okay. He says, well, if you keep that attitude, then you had a good chance of beating this.
Yeah.
And you know, and I did 8 months of chemo, and I, you know, and it was interesting, you know, blood draws got interesting.
Tell the story about the only time I saw you, because I would see you a couple of times a week throughout this whole thing, and I was just amazed at how level-headed and present you were, and how you never felt sorry for yourself. You had a great attitude about it. But I remember you came in one day because you had gone to get chemo and a nurse had kind of pissed you off or something.
Oh, yeah.
Tell that story.
Well, what she did was, I think this is what you're saying. They, you know, the chemo comes through an IV.
Yeah.
And it's in a little bag, and they hang it on the rat, and it comes in through an IV. And anyways, I feel this fire going on in my arm, and I tell her, you know, I'm burning up over here. So she brings me a hot pack, and what the hot pack does, it expands the vein because the chemo's thick, and expands the vein to give it a better flow. And then I look up, and I realize that I says, you know, I realize there's no water, and you're supposed to have the saline, which is a water, as a cut to thin it out, and to, because chemo's poison, and you don't want to run it straight because it's for obvious reasons. So they didn't put no water in it, so the whole side of my body was on fire. And I told her, and she took care of it. And, but I just remembered. I think I know what you're talking about. Yeah. I think you're not talking about, you're talking about a blood draw.
Yeah.
Yeah, this guy, he comes, you know, you would think on blood draws that they would know what they're doing. But this guy comes in, he sticks a needle in my arm, and he hits, there's a lot of pain. I just feel this shooting pain in my arm. And I tell him, I says, hey, something's wrong here. You know, I got this pain going on. He says, I've been doing this for 20 years. I know what I'm doing. And we're in the doctor's office, and I kind of go like, you mean because you've been doing this for 20 fucking years that I'm not feeling the pain that I'm feeling?
Right.
And everybody kind of just looked at me and got kind of quiet in there. And, you know, and he just shined me on like it wasn't a big deal. And he just, you know. And so the next day I went and I told my nurse, the one that was giving me the chemo, I says, hey, you know, this is what happened yesterday. And I says, I think he hit a nerve. And she says, that's exactly what happened. He hit a nerve. He wasn't paying attention to what he was doing. And that was one of those times when I really considered smacking somebody that was treating me. My doctor, he came in one day and started talking to me. And I told him, I says, you know, you got to show a little bit more concern here because I'm all in here. I want to beat this. And if I, you know, you're giving me the impression that you're not really interested in what's going on here, and mm-hmm. I need you to be interested,
right?
You know, because I am,
right?
You know,
right.
I'm planning on beating this. I'm, you know, that's my mindset, and I don't know if I'm going to beat it. I'm hoping, you know, a lot of times I got that moment where I was kind of like the kid whistling in the dark, mm-hmm. kind of thing, but I got to beat it, man. I can't sit there and not for one moment that I sit there saying, my God, I got cancer here, I could die, and you know, or this is painful, or this is, or the nausea, or all the stuff that comes with it, this is too much. I never went there.
Do you think the fact that you had dodged so many bullets before kind of made it less of a big deal?
No.
What do you think?
Because this was a unique. This was a unique challenge. This was a unique fear. I didn't go fearless. There was some fear there. I think I really, really believe that it was because of my connection with my God.
Mm-hmm.
It really is, because I never had that sense of security or sense of well-being before in my life until I made that connection with my God when I got into recovery and I had stopped drinking. And making that connection changed me as a man, as a person. And my whole way of thinking was changed, which meant my whole perspective was changed, which meant my whole foundation of fears changed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I have fears like everybody else. They're just not what they used to be.
Right.
What they used to be was, I used to nurture my fears. I used to think about them a lot. I used to, you know, anxiety, just all this stuff. Because of the way that I was living and the stuff that I dealt with, and I knew that eventually somebody was going to kill me or whatever. And I had certain fears there, but when I got sober and I connected with my God, there was a sense of well-being that I never experienced before, and there was a some courage that I never knew existed within me. And I believe, I'm convinced it came from God, because I didn't have it within me to have that kind of courage.
Right.
I mean, I come from a lifestyle that demanded some courage, but it was all misguided, kind of
a false young man's idea of
exactly
courage.
Exactly. And so this time it was a little more it was different for sure. And I kind of got to the point where I said, well, if I accepted it for what it was, and I said, if I'm gonna die now, if that happens, I'm okay.
Yeah,
I'm really okay, and because of what I've been given.
And I sense that in you, and that is one of the things that kind of cemented my idea of you as somebody that I admire and that I appreciate as a friend, because you had the ultimate test to walk the walk and to walk with poise and to be patient and to, you know, I remember saying to you, you know, you're a couple of months into this cancer thing, you mention it, you wouldn't even mention it as cancer. You would say, yeah, I'm going through some health issues. And I would always say, I would be stopping people on the street and telling them that I had cancer.
You know, I remember sitting with my mom and telling her the day I got cancer, you know, because the day when they told me, I had to go to my mom's and tell her what was up. And I remember sitting there and telling her, and I told her, I says, it's all over my chest and my stomach and my groin, and I'm stage 3. And she started shaking and crying, you know. And, you know, she got pretty shook up, and I thought about it, and I thought, I guess I'm supposed to be scared with her. I remember having that feeling, like, I guess I'm supposed to be scared here, and I'm not, you know, I'm not. I mean, I'm feeling very inconvenienced. You know, fucking cancer, come on, I'm busy. You know, I mean, that's kind of the, you know, it was kind of like, and I said, okay. It seemed like the people around me were a lot more affected than I was. Even my brother was going to finance, he wanted to send me to somewhere on the Gerson program, I think. Some guy claimed to have the cure for cancer. Mm-hmm. I think my brother was going to put up about 10 or 15 grand to have this process done. And he even had a family meeting. And he convinced my siblings to get behind him on this. And I was getting phone calls, you know, from siblings that were crying, asking me to do this. Mm-hmm. And I really resented my brother for that. You know, not because he was, you know, because this was out of love for sure.
Yeah.
And my brother Joe, he's
a great guy.
You know, and he's in my corner for sure. And I know he's doing this out of love.
Yeah.
But the fact is because he believes in it, he figures it's the gospel truth.
Right.
So he sells everybody else on it, and they have this family meeting, and I hear everybody telling me that I should do this. I should do it. I should do it. I'm listening to everybody. Now I know what it's like to be an intervention, right?
Right.
And so at the end, I think either my mom or my older sister asked, maybe we should ask Jesse what he thinks, you know? I was, I get to say something, you know? Right. And I made a decision. I says, I've decided that I'm going to do chemo, you know?
Yeah.
That's my decision. But I had to go to my spiritual advisor to ask him.
Yeah.
You know, I go, man, this, you know, I got my brother doing this thing, and, you know, and I know he's sold on it, but I'm, you know, and Ray told me, he says, it's your body and it's your life. What do you want to do?
End the story.
And that was really what it was. Yeah. And of course, you know, he reminded me, which I already knew. He says, you know, everybody's coming from love and fear.
Mm-hmm.
I said, yeah, I know. And so I had to go say, hey, you know, I'm doing chemo. That's what I'm going to do. And that's what I did. I did it for 8 months and it worked. Yeah. It knocked out the cancer and knocked out the hepatitis. And this coming March, will already be 3 years that I've been in the all clear.
Wow. Wow. Well, I'm so grateful that I got to have extra time with you. And I think a lot of people feel that same way. And I want to thank you for your honesty. And I was going to do a fear off, but we're running a little long already. And there's so much good stuff that I feel like we got enough. Is there anything you want to add before?
Do I get paid in check or cash? And do I get paid today? Because I gotta do some stuff.
Yeah, you're saying you're waiting on a check.
No, yeah, you know what? This is cool. I like the people that are in my life today, and the ones that do stuff like this, and the different guys, because I'm trying to, you know, I'm doing a lot of writing now, and I'm kind of trying to make that transition of being a writer for a living. And I surround myself with people today that impress me on a regular basis of who they are. And you're one of those guys.
Well, I appreciate that. That means a lot to me, coming from a no-nonsense person like you.
It really does. It really does. It really is what makes my life good and has improved the quality of my life. And I got a life I could have never imagined because of the people in it.
Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah. And you're going through some stuff right now. You're going through some, I wouldn't say unemployment, but underemployment. And you always come out the other side. And I got to believe that there is a correlation between acting as if you believe you're going to come out the other side and getting out the other side.
I've never not had a roof over my head. I've never missed a meal. And if I couldn't pay my rent, I would not be homeless. I have too many friends and family that would not allow that.
Yeah.
I would not be homeless. So my greatest fear would be that I would pass judgment on myself about the way that my life is, and I would use that to judge me. That's my greatest fear. I didn't know the strengths I had in my life until there was a challenge put in front of me that demanded that I find what that strength is. So when the seemingly bad happens or the dark days come or whatever it is, I don't get too excited.
Yeah,
I just don't.
And the thing that I would add is not only do you benefit from it, but it makes my life better, because when I'm having a shitty day, I can guarantee you there's many times I was freaking out about something and then I go have dinner with you that night and I'd be like, what the fuck am I freaking out for? This guy just got out of, 4 hours of chemotherapy. And he's completely, present, sitting here at dinner with a smile on his face. And that is the gift. If we just get wrapped up in it, it's all doom, et cetera, we don't get to give that gift to other people of giving them an example of how to live life. And so I just want to thank you for that. And for not robbing me. You know, I know that that's what your people like to do. And I want to thank you for letting me leave here with my wallet. And I couldn't fucking let it go without.
And as long as this thing's still recording, we'll just say it's that way.
I love
it. Of course I'm not going to rob you. Of course.
Do you remember what I said to you when you came and you declared that you were cancer free?
Oh yeah, you said even cancer doesn't like Mexicans. but I know that you have to talk that way, being that you're insecure. And that one time when you told me that you were embarrassed and ashamed for being white, I get it. Then you have to act that way because of that embarrassment. It's okay, I understand. I feel your pain.
I love you, brother.
I love you too.
All right.
Thank you.
Many thanks to Jesse. And if you want to contact him, I'm going to put a link to his Facebook page on our website. That website is metalpod.com. Before I take it out with a listener email, want to thank a couple people that helped make the show possible. My wife Carla for always giving me great feedback. Steve Grieve, who designs and runs the website. John and Michael and Manny, who help keep spammers out of the forum. And, of course, you the listener. And you can support us non-financially by going to iTunes, giving us a good rating, and writing something nice that boosts our ranking, and that brings more people to the show, which we enjoy. This listener email comes from Jeff, and he writes, "I've been depressed for over 20 years without really realizing it. It cost me a well-paying job, a decent marriage, and many friends and relationships. My current wife had recently made me aware of it. My self-hatred has kept me from embracing the idea of treatment until 5 minutes ago. Your podcasts are what changed my mind on the biggest decision in my life. Thank you." Jeff, of all the emails I've gotten, and I've gotten some really nice ones from people, that just really made me smile. And I know I shouldn't depend on things that other people say to validate me, but that fucking validated me. So thank you. Thank you for that. And thank you for everybody that writes in and tells me that this podcast helps them. I really appreciate that. And you guys absolutely helped me feel less alone, less broken, less fucked up, less hopeless. And if you're out there and you're feeling all those things, know that it's not reality. There is hope. You are not alone. And thanks for listening.